Welcome to Rex Factor!
This week, Mary Queen of Scots, the review!
With your hosts, Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello.
Hello,
and welcome to Rex Factor, reviewing all the kings and queens of Scots, from Kenneth MacAlpin to James VI.
Oh, we're so nearly there.
I mean, we dragged
it out a bit with this one, but it has been worth it, though. It's been a ride.
Now, before we get on to the reviewing and doing all the factors, we will just do a summary of her life and reign that we've done in the previous two episodes, just to show that we didn't need to spend all this time.
Is this Mary Queen of Scots, the tweet?
So, Mary Queen of Scots, daughter of James V, that feels a long time ago now,
yeah,
and Mary of Guise, and she was born on the 8th of December 1542, making her 6 days old when she became queen.
Yeah, I mean, it's looking good for longevity, isn't it?
Yeah. She was considered a very pretty child and later a very beautiful woman, nearly 6 foot tall.
That's massive.
And she's praised for her very smooth and pale skin, which is very much de rigueur in the 16th century. So, her father, James V, died in 1542. He suffered a terrible defeat in the Battle of Solway Moss against England and Henry VIII. Lots of nobles taken prisoner. James wasn't at the battle, but he died shortly afterwards, just 30 years old. Possibly from cholera. So, Henry VIII rubbed his hands with glee and thought, this is lovely, I've got my own little boy, Edward, and now Scotland's got its own little Queen Mary, let's bring them together, I will own Scotland by virtue of being daddy-in-law.
Right, but that would have made them related, but distantly.
So he tries to secure Mary as bride for his son Edward. The Scots resist, and then we have what was termed the rough wooing.
Yeah,
dodge. Where Henry just launches lots and lots of really hard, nasty raids into Scotland.
Because they wouldn't marry off.
Now, Mary's mother, Mary of Guise, managed to secure military support from Henri II, the King of France, and she sends Mary, Queen of Scots, over to be brought up at the French royal court, so she's safe from English hands now. And she's betrothed to the Dauphin, whom she marries in 1558.
I still can't go over that. That's a hell of a win, isn't it, for the Queen of Scotland?
And the next year, 1559, Mary, Queen of Scots, becomes Queen Consort of France.
It's huge.
And this is looking good for her at this stage, because lots of Catholics believe that the new English Queen from 1558, Elizabeth I, is illegitimate on account of her mother, Anne Boleyn, and the divorce thing with Catherine of Aragon. Therefore, a lot of people think, well, the next legitimate person in line is Mary, Queen of Scots, because she is descended from Henry VII by her grandmother, Margaret Tudor. But this means that she gets some enemies, particularly when the French king declares her as Queen of England.
Yes.
And chief among these is William Cecil.
Yeah, he hated her, didn't he?
He identifies her as a threat to Elizabeth and as a threat to Protestantism. We also, in Scotland, have a Protestant movement, most famously led by John Knox. And Scottish nobles, under Mary's half-brother, the Earl of Murray, ally with England, reject the Pope's authority. And in 1560, we have the death of Mary of Guise, Mary Queen of Scots' mother, the regent of Scotland. She dies, and the Protestants are now dominant in Scotland.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so the worm has turned.
And it's rather unfortunate timing, because also in 1560 we have the death of Mary's first husband, the King of France, Francis II.
Yeah.
In which case, Mary now is no longer Queen Consort of France. She's going to have to return to Scotland, just as it's become Protestant when she is, of course, Catholic. So in 1561, she does return to Scotland as the Catholic Queen, but she is accepting the status quo. So she says, okay, I accept that the new religion in Scotland is Protestantism. I will continue to be Catholic in private, but I'm not going to disturb all of the reforms that have happened.
A really sort of modern approach to monarchy there.
And she seems to be quite popular early on. She's got lots of progresses all across the country, showing herself to her people. And she is attempting to have herself secured as Elizabeth's heir to be Queen of England, should Elizabeth die without children. And Elizabeth is actually quite sympathetic to Mary being the person with the best claim, but she's reluctant to name anybody as heir.
Yeah.
Whereas William Cecil just doesn't want her to be under any circumstances whatsoever. So, that not working, Mary then makes a marriage alliance with Lord Darnley.
Yes, himself an Englishman and a Catholic.
And Catholic, and he's also got Scottish ancestry. Yeah. So his father is Scottish, his mother is English, and consequently the two of them combined both got claims to the English and Scottish thrones.
From what I recall, it's at this point it all goes downhill.
Yeah, so unfortunately not everybody is happy with this marriage alliance, particularly the Protestant lords in Scotland, who see this as a threat because now we've got a Catholic queen and a Catholic pseudo-king. Mm. And also Earl Murray, her half-brother, the leader of the Protestant lords, has up to this point been her chief advisor, but now Darnley is at court and his father, the Earl of Lennox, who had been exiled for years. There's a rebellion in 1565 led by Murray, but Mary is able to put it down very successfully, what was known as the Chaseabout Raid, because she was just chasing them about Scotland. But after this, as you said, things really went downhill. Darnley turned out to be a rather immature, vain and jealous young man, and he was convinced by the Protestants in exile that Mary was having an affair with her Italian secretary and musician David Rizzio. So in 1566, Darnley helped arrange Rizzio's brutal murder right in front of Mary, who was 6 months pregnant at the time.
That was the most shocking element of that entire story last week. Absolutely amazing. But it was her reaction was so considered.
Yes, yeah, so she was able to get Darnley on side and they then escaped. And then she has a son, James VI. Things are starting to look okay. She's close to a breakthrough with Elizabeth on the succession. But then her husband, Lord Darnley, is assassinated.
Right, and who's the culprit there?
Well, that's the problem. Mary falls under suspicion herself because she marries the man suspected of his murder, which is Earl Bothwell.
Not good.
Because she marries him, that's the final straw for a lot of nobles. They think, right, well, we can't stand by and allow this to happen. So they rebel, exile Bothwell, imprison Mary, and then force her to abdicate the throne in 1567.
Right.
Now, she is able to escape from her imprisonment, raises a very large army, but unfortunately, in 1568, at the Battle of Langside, her forces are defeated by the Earl of Murray. And this time she panics and goes into exile in England, hoping that Elizabeth will help restore her to her Scottish throne.
And she can never... you're right. From that point, it never gets better, does it? Because she's in the quicksand then.
Problem for Elizabeth is that Mary, as a Catholic, being in the largely Catholic north of England, means that there's now a figurehead for Catholic rebellions.
Yeah.
A number of plots in the early years remove any hope of assistance from Elizabeth, and consequently Mary spends the next 19 years basically under house arrest. She then ends up trying to sort of get herself involved in some of the plots against Elizabeth. She's largely tried to keep herself aloof in terms of signing a name to anything, but clearly giving a bit of a nod and a wink. But she's caught out by the Babington plot. Where she is really seen as agreeing to the assassination of Elizabeth I. Consequently, she is tried and beheaded at Fotheringay Castle on the 8th of February 1587, just 44 years old.
Poor old Mary.
Poor Mary. It was a dramatic life and quite a tragic life, really.
Yeah.
All in all.
Yeah, yeah.
But how is she going to fare when we actually review her against our factors?
Okay, ready.
Battleliness!
So, obviously, things don't end particularly well for Mary.
No.
But there are some successes in her reign. Early on, in 1562, when she started her personal rule in Scotland, she put down the Huntly Rebellion. Now, Huntly was actually the leading Catholic magnate in Scotland.
Right. Yeah,
and he got angry when the earldom of Murray was given to Mary's half-brother, James Stuart, because he felt that it was within his sort of territory, it should have been going to someone in his family. There was a dispute involving his eldest son, and Mary demanded that said son be imprisoned, but Huntly wouldn't hand him over.
Trouble brewing.
Mary headed up to Inverness Castle, which was one of the ones owned by Huntly, but the captain of the castle refused her entry.
I remember this now. Yeah, 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 yeah. Which I still can't get over.
Yes, and you were sort of thinking about the poor guy that has to deliver the no order.
Yeah.
It didn't go well for him. Mary raised a large force from sort of all around in northern Scotland, captured the castle, executed the captain, and then went to Aberdeen.
That's unfair. I mean, that's a literal case of shooting the messenger. I mean, what a poor guy. I'm really pleased that I was born when I was. I don't think I'd liked it.
Now, Huntly decides to march on Aberdeen, but the Earl of Murray has a much larger army that Mary's managed to raise, so we have the Battle of Corrochie, where Murray easily defeats Huntly. captures a large number of them. Huntley dies of apoplexy almost immediately afterwards.
Really?
But his body was then preserved and put on trial a few weeks later.
That's proper vengeance, isn't it? Like that it's... it was against Catholics, wasn't it?
Mm.
That she wasn't just bashing in the heads of the Protestants.
Mm. In 1565, we have the Chaseabout raid, where she bashes in the heads of the Protestants.
Yay!
So this followed, as we said, the marriage to Lord Darnley, who was sort of a Catholic, which unsettles a lot of Protestants. But probably more important was that Darnley coming back and also his father, Lennox, coming back really upsets the balance of power. Murray leads Protestant lords, claiming that they're aiming to protect the Protestant settlement from a Catholic restoration.
Mm.
And they're also preserving alliance with England because they think, oh, these Catholics are going to send us back to France and Europe and all this sort of stuff.
And they want an alliance with England just to maintain some peace. And,
And Protestantism.
Oh, of course, yeah, every time.
But Mary does a good bit of PR before it's been invented by...
I was going to ask whether she invented it.
She reconfirms the religious status quo. Attended mass less often and volunteers to attend Protestant sermons, as do Darnley and Lennox.
That's a massive step, isn't it? I mean, I can't imagine anyone else in her family giving any ground like that.
Though maybe like Elizabeth, she's a little bit more sort of equivocal about this sort of thing. Mary Tudor was much more absolute about her faith.
Yeah.
Whereas Elizabeth and Mary Queen of Scots are maybe a bit more willing to kind of keep their head down.
Just get through
the situation.
I wish they'd met. I reckon they'd have been great friends.
But it seems to have worked. There's no evidence that Protestants felt that they were under threat. In fact, John Knox even doesn't speak up in favour of the Earl of Murray at this stage.
Oh, well, okay.
Mm. So Mary recalls the Earl of Bothwell, who had been exiled previously by Murray and Arran, restores the Hamilton family to the earldom of Huntly, and she rides out at head of an army numbering somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000. And that outnumbers the Protestants by about 5 to 1.
Wow. Mm. Must have been quite overwhelming.
So the rebels under Murray gathered in Ayrshire on the 26th of August. Mary sets out from Holyrood House to confront them at Glasgow.
Mm.
31st of August, Murray, having sort of moved around to avoid them, now tries to capture Edinburgh, from which Mary had just left.
Yeah.
But the castle remained loyal, fires its cannons at them, and they're forced to retreat to Dumfries.
Okay, so the castle keeper there was doing what he was told again.
Yeah.
You're not allowed in, for God's sake! Bang!
Mary almost caught the Protestants on the way to Dumfries, so they do manage to get there, but they're in a bit of an impossible position, so Murray sends a request to Elizabeth for guns, money and troops.
When you say almost caught them, is it like they were seen so dust in the distance? And...
Yeah, so Mary's at the head of this huge army, and she's chasing the Protestant lords, and if she can just get to them and capture them, then they're completely screwed.
Yeah.
So presumably, like you said, they're nearly there. They're not far off them.
They have like scouts saying they were seen over there. Oh, it's quite exciting, isn't it? You got in these days of films, you'd sort of see a little dot on a map going blip 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 blip. You'd be trying to get close to it. But there, it's just sending out riders and hearing rumour. Really exciting.
It's your Pac-Man moment when the sort of Murray just jumps off the screen and appears on the other side.
Yeah, of one side. Exactly. Yeah.
So he makes a request to Elizabeth. An English ship does reach the Firth, but it's bombarded by Scots cannons and forced to retreat.
Mm.
So Murray at this point really has run out of options, and they cross the border at Carlisle, escape into England.
Yeah.
And they're hoping they're going to get good treatment, but Elizabeth and Cecil, not very impressed with how they've just been hounded out of Scotland, and don't offer them any support at all. Now, in terms of Mary's role, apparently she's dressed in a steel cap, bearing a pistol, and she's actually at the front quite a lot of the time, charging around on her horse after Murray. Really seems to be in her element and enjoying the thrill of the chase.
Wow, that's pretty cool, isn't it?
Randolph, the English ambassador, said, "The Queen followeth them so near with such forces, so much the stronger by reason of her musketeers, that she giveth them no time to rest in any place."
So she's running along saying, "Come on, lazy bones, get a move on."
And she even gets some grudging praise of a sort from one John Knox.
I don't believe you.
"Albeit the most part waxed weary, yet the Queen's courage increased manlike so much that she was ever with the foremost."
Sort of, isn't it? I mean, he's saying she's nearly a man. She's got an...
Yeah.
Oh, The arrogance.
It's not a glowing praise, but nevertheless, he is having to admit that she was full of courage and vim, and she's the one with all the energy at the front, charging around doing it all.
Must be the only time on record he's ever said anything that isn't negative about that.
So we see a lot of courage, personal courage from Mary. If we compare with Elizabeth, always very, very cautious, prefers kind of just do nothing, wait and see, let events play themselves out. Mm. Mary, in contrast, if there's a crisis, she likes to do something.
Yeah, certainly.
She responds to things and gets her hands dirty.
Yeah, and it's with a refreshing sort of almost childlike innocence. There's no politicking there. It's not, oh, I'll try and support this guy over that guy. She's trying to keep everything together, and she's going to do what she does, what she can to support that, whoever's doing the rebelling. Mm. And she thinks, well, we have to go and fight them. I'll get my metal cap on. Yeah. Off we go. Come on. Chop, chop.
So you were like impressed, we said, with David Rizzio, the way that she responds after that, very clear-headed. You know, she was 6 months pregnant. She said that she'd felt the sort of the air of a knife just going past her. She has a pistol pointed at her during this. She may have even thought that she was a target and that they were going to end up killing her.
Yeah.
So she keeps her cool, manages to split her husband, Darnley, away from the other conspirators. Then they make a daring escape. So they leave Holyrood House via an underground passage, then ride 25 miles to Dunbar for about 5 hours. They have to stop several times for her to be sick because, as we said, she is 6 months pregnant when doing all of this.
Wow. That is some... She is seriously brave. Amazing.
And at the Battle of Carbery Hill, rides at the head of the army. Her hair apparently is all messed up. She's wearing a red petticoat with sleeves tied with points, a partlet, a velvet hat, and a muffler.
A velvet hat this time, crikey.
And her skirt, apparently, scarcely reached halfway down her legs.
Whoa, it's worth commenting. You know exactly who's writing this. It's like the Daily Mail today. It's like not commenting on Mr. May's suit was a trendy little number. It's, they'd never mentioned what James V was riding out in.
Yeah.
The whole, I like the description of the hair there, like she's a Boudicca type figure, wild, really cool.
And we also have her escape from Loch Leven Castle. So this is after Carbery Hill, where she's imprisoned and made to abdicate. She's there for 11 months and had suffered a miscarriage early on of twins via Bothwell. Mm. But she doesn't lose heart. She tries to escape. Initially, she's disguised as a washerwoman, but the guy rowing her out recognises her sort of pale and well-kept hands.
Yeah. Classic.
So rows her back, but doesn't tell the keeper of the castle.
Oh, that's good of him.
Mm. But the next one is successful. The page of the castle sabotages all but one of the boats, because this castle's in the middle, little island in the middle of the loch. So sabotages all but one of them, steals the keys, and then while all the rest of the family is at dinner, gets Mary out, rows her across the loch, where George Douglas, the smitten younger brother of the laird of the castle, is waiting with some fine horses to take her away.
I'd love that. I want to hear the next stage of that, though. What happens to the family? Are they trapped there for the rest of their lives and die in old age, sitting at the table? We've got no boats. They have to wait for the washerman to come back. Oh, poor chaps.
So there's actually quite a lot of appealing stuff there. We've got personal courage. She's at the head of the army. She's doing stuff.
Mm. If this is not meant to sound as sexist as it's going to, but I try to give it some... imagining this was a king, because I think a lot of the sources we've got are written by men who are, saying...
quite a high proportion.
Yeah, well, yeah, slash 100%. We're all saying, and she was wearing this and wearing that, and it was most unladylike, but actually the things that she was doing...
Mm.
We've got the escapes that we loved in Edward III Styles' reign. So far, she couldn't have done any more if she were a man, is what I mean.
Mm. But we do, unfortunately, have some pretty definitive military defeats.
Right.
The first of these is, to be fair, when she's just a child, so she's not really got any control over it, but we do cover events in their reign. This is the Battle of Pinkie Cleugh.
Oh, yeah, that's a bad name.
So the 10th of September in 1547. So this is all part of the rough wooing. The Scots have got an army of about 30,000 men, led by Arran, and indeed the Earl of Angus, who, if you recall, he was the one who, in the minority of James V, married James's mother, Margaret Tudor. And then he was regent for a number of years, and then James eventually comes to the throne.
Oh, yes.
And Aaron gets and Angus get sent off to England. Well, he's still kicking around, and when James V dies, Angus comes back.
God, he's lucky that James V died young, isn't he? Oh, he flips anyway, doesn't he, this
indeed. Unfortunately, Aaron and Angus don't have a very good relationship, so the two of them leading the Scottish force is perhaps not the best.
Yeah, that's Darcy trouble. So you've got two separate armies, really. Mm.
The English have only got 17,000 men, but they're much better armed, much more disciplined, and their leaders, so we've got Somerset, who is now the Lord Protector for Edward VI, and Warwick, who John Dudley, much more experienced commanders as well. The Scots are commanding a bridge and protected by earthen parapets, so they've got quite a good position in the battle. But the English have got ships in the Forth, quite nearby, and Somerset is trying to capture a nearby hillock.
Right.
So that he'll be able to fire down on the Scots.
Okay, yeah.
Angus and the cavalry lead an attack and get routed pretty quickly. Aaron abandons his strong defensive position to try and defend the hillock when he sees that Somerset's heading after it, but his troops come under heavy fire, and then when they try to get out, they're not really able to because they're kind of caught in the crossfire. They're not able to organise things. As a result, somewhere between 10 and 15,000 casualties for the Scots and only about 250 for the English.
Wow! That's a huge disparity.
It's quite a big defeat for the Scots.
Yeah. But hang on. 10 to 15,000 defeated. Dead.
Yeah. Or wounded. You know.
Or wounded, or but prisoner. Off the field.
Yeah.
And how many did the English have in total?
17,000.
So actually, it just ends up an even fight. Yeah. It should have carried on. They should have just done a quick head count and gone, no, we'll carry on. Yeah.
Now, the Battle of Carbery Hill.
Yeah.
We mentioned as a positive that she's riding along with her hair down and her skirts barely covering her knee.
Yeah.
But it isn't a very impressive showing overall. This is on the 15th of June, 1567. It's after the murder of Darnley and the marriage to the unpopular Earl of Bothwell.
But that was forced, wasn't it?
Yeah, possibly, potentially. Yeah. So the nobles have raised an army ostensibly to rescue Mary, but, you know. Anyway, the two armies are quite well matched, and it's a very hot day, and no one quite actually wants to fight.
They just want to chill out with a cider.
So they have a standoff where they're going to try and negotiate and try and get a way out of it. The lords demand that Mary quit Bothwell, which she refuses to do. So the lords then offer to settle the battle by single combat with Bothwell.
Yeah, I love that idea.
And Bothwell demands that he fights the Earl of Morton, who is the one that he had actually kind of been involved with, you know, in conspiring against Darnley.
Okay.
And now Morton had turned against him. Morton is also 15 years older and not a very natural soldier and not particularly keen to take him up on this. Eventually they agree that the younger Lord Lindsay will stand in place of Morton and fight Bothwell.
Must have been an awkward chat for Morton, though, because definitely don't
He's agreed!
That. Yeah.
Morton, you ready for this?
Oh, God, I've got a string in my leg.
But they are going to have single combat until Mary intervenes and prevents it. She thinks that probably she's going to lose either way. If Bothwell loses, then she's alone and completely lost. If he wins, they could just attack anyway, because it's only one man. So what's to be gained from a single combat?
And it's just men being all testosterone-fueled men. She's just telling the boys to stop being so silly.
Yeah. So, Mary agrees to surrender to the lords on proviso that Bothwell is allowed to escape.
Good idea.
Particularly because morale has dropped across the day with it being so hot and nothing happening, and Bothwell, who's kind of the cause of all of this, not yet fighting single combat. A lot of Mary's troops probably think, well, can't really be bothered with this.
Yeah, but that's a great outcome, though, isn't it?
Well, is it? Bothwell heads off. Mary is taken into custody by the Scottish lords.
Rescued.
Imprisoned on a castle.
Yeah.
Forced to abdicate. And we haven't even had a shot fired.
Yeah.
This is a battle for her kingdom, in effect. And ultimately she decides to save Bothwell and give in rather than actually fight for it.
I don't know why. Maybe I'm just being sympathetic because it's exactly what I'd have chosen to do, I think.
Is there a way that we could just not fight and
all go live? Home? I've got an awful lot of reading to do. You want me to retire? That is totally fine.
Finally, we have the Battle of Langside. This is the 13th of May in 1568. So she was forced to abdicate, but as we said, she manages to escape from Loch Leven. And she very quickly raises an army which is much larger than that which the Earl of Murray is able to call upon.
So
people are flocking to her. She's got that inherent popularity very quickly. She's got a big army. So Mary offers a pardon to the Earl of Murray and then takes her army and marches west to Dumbarton Castle, which is a prized fortress on the west coast.
So she's not really queen again yet. She's sort of she's out and she's walking around. So some people are saying she's queen still.
Yeah, and she's got the biggest army in Scotland. And if she gets to Dumbarton, she'll have ownership of east and west castles.
Yeah.
So and we're kind of into a chase about raid scenario again where Murray's got nowhere to go. Just big impenetrable castles.
Right.
Murray refuses the pardon, and he realises that basically if she's able to take back control, then he's finished. He's not getting out of this one. So he decides to force her into battle, which again, she wants to avoid. So Murray and Morton again carefully position their troops around the village of Langside. The Earl of Argyll is leading Mary's forces, but unfortunately he doesn't seem to be particularly capable. And also falls a little bit ill. So he basically just tries to force his way through Murray's troops by sheer force of numbers. But actually Murray's got men in hedgerows and buildings all around the town. It's all quite well laid out for a good defensive battle. Argyll's first attack is held up by a shot. Then there's this sort of pike-based melee for a few hours. Argyll may be doing quite well at one stage, but a very effective counterattack from Murray sees Argyll's forces completely routed. After about 45 minutes, battle is lost despite numerical superiority.
Where does she get these people from?
And then, of course, she makes that fateful decision not to stay in Scotland, but to flee to England. Yeah. Now, in a way, you can understand this.
Yeah.
Because, you know, she just lost the battle. She's worried that she might be James III scenario where she will happen to be slain.
Yeah.
But the defeat wasn't a total disaster. There aren't particularly heavy casualties. And it deprives her supporters of her person. They can't restore an absent queen. Their figurehead is gone. If she'd just stayed, gone back to a stronghold, got more troops together.
And I do feel like she's standing next to the river and thinks, oh, crumbs, they're coming, and jumps in the river, and she's stuck in this quicksand that eventually will swallow her. The quicksand of England. And she's got no... she's got no way out then. I do think that at this time we're going to start to see fewer and fewer kings doing the actual charging into battle. And here she is doing what she can and really sort of really actually being there up in the forefront, where many other kings would be quite happily, you know, taking a back seat, being a general in a castle, commanding troops. She just doesn't have the big support of generals who know what they're doing. She's trying to do it all on her own, it seems. And those... it's really annoying. I want to give her a bigger score than I feel I can.
The thing is, she does ultimately lose.
Utterly.
Yeah.
Yeah. But she's got a tartan cap on with metal and pistols and riding in. Taking charge in every sense of the word. I want to give a 5, but I don't know whether I can really. I think I'm going to go 4. Just not quite. Oh, I feel really bad. I feel really bad for her. Yeah. I really like her. And I just the situation at this time, you know, all the geopolitics are so nearly. They always get one when they're so nearly there, and then the tide turns, and she's just completely adrift in that tide, and it goes from one way to the other, and eventually, as the metaphor goes, the quicksand swallows her. But she does everything she can. 4.
I mean, a similar mark, ultimately. I'm going to go 3.5. Yeah. I think I'm giving her credit for personal courage that she shows.
Yeah.
The sort of courage under fire, I suppose, like when there are those crisis moments, like with Rizzio, like when she's imprisoned and she escapes.
Yeah.
It's all very impressive. And she does have success with the chase about raid and things like this.
And her courage on the block.
But, unfortunately, battliness, I think if you're losing all of the battles that you really need to win, you know, if you're forced from your throne, effectively twice, I suppose, because she escapes and then loses again.
Do you know what she's like? Like West Ham. Decide that every so often we'll go away and beat Manchester United, but they can't win the games that matter against Burnley or something, and ultimately it's not going to win you the title.
So that's just 7.5 for battliness.
Scandal!
Well, I think this is probably the factor where people are going to expect the biggest score for Mary. First of all, Mary as a femme fatale.
Oh, I like it. Let's go.
Mary and the men. First of all, there was a chap called Pierre de Boscosel de Chassalade.
Oh, yeah.
He's a French poet.
And, of course he was.
But in Scotland, who becomes rather obsessed with Mary. And he was discovered hiding under her bed in 1563, and so banished from court. But then 2 days later, he returns. And so when Mary's in sort of almost a state of slight undress, he just sort of appears.
Creepy?
It's a little bit creepy. The reason I'm putting it here in Scandal is, of course, because Mary's enemies, the John Knoxes of this world, will be like, oh, French poets in her bedroom. What's going on there?
Yeah, yeah. Can't get anything more scandalous in sort of 16th century Britain than a French poet in a bedroom.
There's never a perfectly innocent explanation for a French poet in a bedroom.
Excuse me, who are you? I'm innocently recounting some lyrics. Oh, yeah. It's like a 50s postcard.
As such, obviously, he is betrayed and he is tried and beheaded.
Oh, and, I'm not expecting that.
On his way to the scaffold, he is crying out protestations of his love for Mary.
Yeah, that wasn't going to help.
She does, of course, then get to marry in Scotland, and she marries Lord Darnley. Now, you know, royal families, there tends to be a certain amount of closeness and that sort of thing. Let's be fair, though, they are actually first cousins.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Goodness
me.
Apparently some at court were a bit dubious about Lord Darnley as a match. One particularly rugged Scottish noble lord said that he is more like a woman than a man, beardless and lady-faced.
An accusation that has been laid at my door many times, so I sympathise. But
David Rizzio, the Italian musician and secretary, nobles were able to convince Lord Darnley that Mary was having an affair with Mr. Rizzio, and indeed that he was the real father of her baby on the way.
Well, to be fair, the Italian music teacher is only second to a French poet. I mean, after that, all you've got is, I don't know, a Latin school teacher, and you've got the full set.
We then have, after the assassination of her husband, Lord Darnley, she marries the man who is widely believed to have murdered him just a few months afterwards. This being Earl Bothwell, of course.
What was the story about it being forced?
Well, we'll look at that in a little bit more detail, but some do suggest that the story of her being kidnapped by Bothwell was maybe a front for a kind of a pre-planned elopement. So it was maybe a story that was invented to discredit Bothwell.
Yeah.
Maybe be a bit more generous to the Queen, but actually maybe in reality, maybe Mary and Bothwell were already having an affair when Darnley was,
crikey,
was alive.
Okay.
Hence they together want to assassinate
and
Darnley.
Her decision on the battlefield?
Yeah. Certainly a lot of people are scandalised by her marriage to Bothwell.
Yeah, well, I am.
She escapes from Lothlevin Castle, thanks in no small part to the fact that the younger brother of William Douglas, who's the keeper of the castle, little Georgie Douglas, becomes rather smitten with her and helps her to escape. So if we're going to be writing some Philippa Gregory romances, then I think...
Old Georgie Douglas.
Finally, we've got the Earl of Shrewsbury. So he and his wife, Bess of Hardwick, are charged with basically keeping Mary, Queen of Scots, for most of her time when she's exiled in England. So they've got to put up the costs, keep her in their various mansions.
They're her friendly jailers.
Friendly jailers. But Shrewsbury massively falls out with his wife, Bess of Hardwick, and Bess spreads rumours that her husband and Mary are having an affair.
True or false, do we think?
Well, he's a bit old and sickly by this point, Shrewsbury, and it's probably just to discredit both Mary and Shrewsbury, but nevertheless, it's another Yet another headline.
I feel like all of this is nonsense, and poor Mary is just getting the blunt end of it.
The biggest thing, though, is the assassination of husband number two, Lord Darnley.
Mm.
Their relationship had very quickly soured after their marriage. Mary refused to grant him the crown matrimonial because he was such a vain, shallow and useless person. And he wants to be king.
Yeah.
He wants to be King King Darnley. So he was recuperating from illness in 1567, probably syphilis. And he was in Glasgow. Now, Mary persuades him to come to Kirkafield, which is near Holyrood in Edinburgh. And on the night of the murder, Mary remembered that she'd promised to attend a servant's wedding. And so left the house.
Oh, yes. Mm. Yeah.
The lodge is then destroyed by gunpowder, but suspiciously, well, strangely, Darnley and his valet are found dead under a tree in the garden without any mark of an explosion on their bodies, next to a chair, a rope and an unused dagger, strangled.
So, there's no element that was a mistake, was there? There was, it wasn't actually, oh, I left the kettle on and the gunpowder caught light. That's... And she happened to remember...
Oh, I've just remembered. I've got a wedding to go to in the middle of the night.
I'm the Queen of Scotland, and my diary is such that I'm capable of forgetting where I'm meant to be the next day. That's really, really weak.
In terms of what happened, some speculated that Darnley had been thrown from the building by the explosion, but as I said, there are no marks on him, so it's more likely that he heard the commotion as they were preparing to set the gunpowder off, was lowered out of the room, possibly on the chair, maybe had a dagger with him, because it was a dangerous situation, but the conspirators run around, find him in the garden, strangle him, leave him under a tree.
Should have... I mean, this isn't How to Get Away with Murder podcast, but just drop him in the flames.
Just throw him back in.
Yeah.
Mm.
Ooh, that's horrible, isn't it?
Now, a lot of people suspected that Bothwell wanted to replace Darnley as Mary's husband, and he was actually the sheriff of Edinburgh at this time, so he's the one whose job it is to turn up and investigate.
Mm.
So to make sure that there's absolutely no sense of foul play here and any suspicion could be levied against him, he refuses to let anybody examine the body and sends all the witnesses home. Elizabeth writes to Mary urging that justice is done, and it's an unusually direct letter from Elizabeth. There's no subterfuge in it at all. But Bothwell's trial is an absolute farce. He turns up with armed men, absolutely packs the town and the court with armed men. Lennox, the father of Darnley, who brought the case against him, fears for his life and consequently doesn't go, and Bothwell is acquitted.
I mean, I just don't understand how justice worked enough in those days, but that sounds like it perhaps wasn't done.
And Mary does seem to be a little guilty in her behaviour. She still attended the wedding the next day.
Yeah.
She delayed putting the court into mourning for 5 days, and she denied him a state funeral, so apparently it was done quietly during the night.
Huh.
And then, of course, she marries Bothwell just a few months later.
Yeah, that is... I thought that was just rumour, but actually that sounds like it's really... Hang on, that deserves a ding-dong. Dong.
However, there's an awful lot of... rumour and gossip against Mary, and as you pointed out, quite a few of these things, a lot of it doesn't have an awful lot of base to it. In terms of the femme fatale reputation, which again very much a product of sort of misogynistic men who just pinning sexual indiscretion on her just because she's a woman, it's hardly a fault that a French poet was obsessed with her. And she was actually terrified, as you would be, when she discovered him and tried to get Murray to kill him on the spot.
Yeah, okay.
No evidence that she was having an affair with the Italian musician and her secretary. With Bothwell, most people do believe that she was genuinely kidnapped by him. So what was happening was that she'd been to see her son, James VI, for the last time, as it turned out, and then on the road, Bothwell comes along and takes her prisoner. There's then a suggestion that she was also raped by Bothwell, and that's what forces her to marry him, because she's got to sort of protect her honour, as it were. Now, it's not clear in this whether she was raped or perhaps he wore her down with his sort of pleas and his urgings and protestations of devotion. Either way, it's still obviously a certain amount of coercion.
But was she definitely taken prisoner? I mean, if she was taken prisoner, then all the other bits of the jigsaw puzzle don't quite fit anymore. But if she was didn't. Then it fits more naturally. It's scandalous either way, isn't it?
Mm. But from her part, if she is kidnapped, it's
innocence, yeah.
Yeah, she's not her fault.
She's had such a rough time of it.
So overall, there's not really much evidence to support accusations of these affairs. It's all really propaganda against Mary.
Mm.
Now, the assassination of Lord Darnley.
Mm.
You are, despite being on Mary's side, you're quite suspicious of her involvement.
Yeah, I'm. What? Well, I was going to say that I'm prepared to acquit her of all of these scandalous things like apart from Darnley.
Okay. Well, she has a motive to control and sideline Darnley, but not to murder him, because we remember this was when she was negotiating with Elizabeth to try and secure herself as the heir in England.
Yeah.
So murdering Darnley when things are really starting to look like they could happen is going to blow all of those negotiations out of the water. It's the worst possible moment for Mary, really, for Darnley to have been murdered.
Unless it was love. Real love.
Hmm. So in 1569, Elizabeth, prompted by Cecil, did actually try to establish whether Mary had killed Darnley. And Murray produces these letters, which are supposed to show her guilt. And these are known as the casket letters. So they're supposedly written between Mary and Bothwell, and it's meant to demonstrate that they were lovers while Darnley was still alive.
Right.
And had conspired against him. Most likely, the letters are either forged or taken completely out of context. Mm. And indeed, Cecil doesn't seem to be very impressed by them, and he actually has to correct some translations that they get wrong. Now, if Mary isn't guilty, then who is?
Mm.
Well, after the Rizzio murder, and we'd had those Protestant lords that had been with Darnley.
Yeah.
Darnley just completely abandons them and said, I had nothing to do with this. I didn't know what was going on here. Nothing to do with me. All these lords that are exiled, particularly Earl Morton, is pretty furious with Darnley, and they want revenge.
Mm.
And so we have the Craigmillar Conference, which takes place while Mary's recuperating from illness, but we've got Maitland, Bothwell, Huntley and Argyle discussing how they might be rid of the problem of Darnley. Mm. Mary, when she's told about this, is open to the idea of some kind of separation, but she's fearful of anything that will make James VI illegitimate.
Yeah, yeah.
And the nobles are fearing the power of the Lennox family, so they think if we push out Darnley, there's a threat that his father, Lennox, will then just come in with his forces and we'll have civil war and it'll all be a bit dangerous. So the nobles persuade Mary to pardon the Earl of Morton and the other exiled Rizzio conspirators so that they'll have enough allies to take on Lennox and Darnley.
Morton's the old fella?
Yeah.
Okay, yep.
So from Mary's perspective, quite a lot of this is actually a bit of a coincidence. She was aware that Darnley was writing to the Pope and Catholic sovereigns in Europe with a view potentially to imprisoning her and basically taking over government for himself. So she wants to move him from Glasgow, which is Lennox land, to Kirk of Fields, which is Edinburgh and is near her.
Mm.
So she's got a motivation to move him because she doesn't want him to be staying with all his powerful relatives that are scheming against her.
Yeah.
She doesn't realise that by moving him, she's brought him perfectly into place for the plot that all the other nobles have got to kill Darnley.
Yes. Yes. Okay. All right.
Also, of course, we've got William Cecil.
Mm.
He'd been aware of the plotting to murder Rizzio.
Oh, right.
But obviously doesn't tell Mary about this. And he sends an envoy to help persuade Mary to pardon the conspirators, and in particular Morton, who ultimately leads the plot to kill Darnley. So Cecil doesn't plan Darnley's murder, but he very much does set things in motion that causes the chaos.
Yeah, he's setting a scene that could allow it to happen.
And in 1587, the historian Ralph Holinshed wrote, "The cause, the contriving, and the execution of Darnley's murder was at least in part due to great persons now living."
Meaning Cecil. Right.
So in a way, it's the ultimate example of history being written by the winners, because it's almost as if all of the Scottish nobles plot to kill Darnley.
Yeah.
And then blame Mary.
Yeah. Oh, maybe she's innocent of this as well.
Maybe. Bothwell probably is guilty. He almost certainly is one of the leading conspirators.
I just can't get my head around her forgetting a wedding the next day. She has... surely she's got a PA. Maybe James VI invented a PA as a result of this. I can't decide, Graham.
It's tricky. So we've got a lot of scandal. We've got all these rumours of affairs. We've got her plotting. We've got the murder of her husband and the connivance with Bothwell. And yet there's an explanation for all of these that suggests that maybe she's kind of the victim in all of this and everybody else.
Yeah, I think it's either a massive score or a big fat zero.
You know, it's not fair to say, no smoke without fire.
Mm.
But, you know, if there's an investigation and there's a complete whitewash and he's got this huge list of things,
yeah,
and you think, oh, there's every single one of them, it was somebody else. You think, was there nothing that she did wrong? Was there nothing? No scheming?
That's got to happen sometimes.
Her behaviour does seem suspicious with the whole Darnley thing.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's because she was glad that he was dead, but wasn't involved in actually doing it, and consequently she doesn't bother to appear sad and makes it look worse.
Yeah, I think she hated him and just couldn't summon up crocodile tears.
Yeah.
I'm going to give her... What are you going to give her, Graham?
I guess the key question is the extent to which you think she had some kind of relationship with Bothwell. Was she completely a victim there?
It all boils down to, was she captured or was she not, really?
Yeah.
My gut was yes, but there are so many other people who it could have been.
Mm.
I'll give her two.
At the very least, I suppose, she knows that the nobles are talking about finding a way out of Darnley and getting rid of him.
Mm.
She's like, well, I'm aware that something's being discussed in this room. Don't tell me what you decide.
And I'll turn the telly up.
I'll probably be quite happy with it. Is it that kind of scenario? Is she giving a nod and a wink to the plot?
Yeah. I think if she's guilty of anything, it's that.
Mm.
She doesn't want to get old big Lennox Lewis involved with his troops and come storming in. But she also wants to be shot of him.
Mm.
Oh, I'll give it two. because I think that there's something there, but actually I think she's innocent of all of the scandal involving the love interest, or not, rather. Mm. And she's being just slandered.
Mm.
And is just having to perhaps at times be a bit plotting just to survive.
Mm.
Two, I feel a bit bad. I didn't think I'd be this conflicted with her scores.
No.
What about you? What are you giving her?
Yeah, it is tricky, the scandal one, and this is one which I guess is a perennial issue when reviewing sort of powerful women in history, that there's going to be lots and lots of rumour about them.
Mm.
It ultimately means they got a lower score.
Yeah.
But I think we have to kind of be honest and say, if we don't think that she's guilty as charged of all these things, then she does have to get a lower score for scandal.
Mm.
I feel like there's some murkiness there, particularly with the Darnley murder. I don't think she was involved in the plotting. I do think that took her by surprise. But equally, I feel like she must have been aware to a certain extent of stuff that was going on.
Mm.
And even if she wasn't guilty of it, her behaviour afterwards fuels the scandal.
Yeah,
the way that Bothwell doesn't get tried properly, the way that she ends up marrying him, all this sort of stuff does add to the speculation. So even if it was speculation based on false gossip, she still acted in a way that's inflamed it.
Inflamed it, yeah.
So, still not going to be a high score, but I think I'm going to give her a three.
Okay. And five? That's not bad. Well, it is bad, isn't it?
It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Subjectivity.
She's got a very winning personality.
Certainly does.
Even from when she's young, she seems to have a certain sort of assurance about her. So her mother-in-law at the time, Catherine de' Medici, demanded why Mary didn't bow to the Queen of France.
Ooh.
So Catherine enters the room, Mary doesn't bow. What are you up to? To which Mary responds, why do you not bow to the Queen of Scotland?
Good point. Cool. That's cool. I like that.
Yeah. The historian John Guy said that many contemporaries remarked on her almost magical ability to create the impression that the person she was talking to was the only one whose opinion really mattered to her.
Billy Clinton, isn't it?
Yeah, she's got that just, well, not getting ahead of ourselves, but that sort of star quality for a politician.
That we call Bill Clinton.
But, you know, that magnetic thing, you know, whether she's speaking to a large crowd on a progress or an individual one-on-one, she's often able to win people over and appeal to them.
Mm.
And as said, she goes on lots of progresses, and she's really trying to make sure that her people see her and come to support her, because she's obviously been away in France for most of her reign at the start. 1562 to 63, she spends most of her time travelling, over 1,200 miles covered.
Wow.
July to September 1564, about 460 miles covered in the northeast.
Still.
In 1565, about 6 out of the first 9 months were spent on Progress. So overall, she stayed with about 80 hosts and really helped to inspire loyalty across the country.
And saved an awful lot of money.
She's at the centre of a glittering and glamorous court, following on from sort of her grandfather and father. Mm. She patronises and inspires various poets, encourages and participates in dances, and has a very jolly time of it. And we also see lots of honours, particularly after her marriage to Darnley. Apparently 20 knighthoods and 5 earls bestowed.
That's a good way of getting some support, isn't it? Some pretty permanent support.
The English ambassador Randolph complained that he could hardly turn round without bumping into a new peer. She's a competent singer and could accompany herself on the lute and liked to participate in ensemble singing. But she really had a flair for dancing, which she encourages at all times.
Right.
So it's quite party time.
Yeah, I didn't imagine it should be party.
She's also quite sporting. Hmm. Loves her falconry. Which quite impressed people because it's seen as more of a masculine.
Manulin's a great word.
Not sure what it should mean. She loves riding, something she does every day, and hunting. Mm. She was also a keen golf player.
Rex fact.
Now, allegedly, she popularises the term caddy, which is, of course, the person that carries the clubs, because in France, the tradition was that military cadets carried clubs for royalty. So when she comes back to Scotland, she pronounces cadet as cadet.
Cadet. Ah, that's amazing.
Whether or not this is true or just...
Oh, no, I don't want to hear it. That is fantastic. I'm going away with that fact forever.
Allegedly, one of the other things we could have added to her guilty behaviour about Darnley's murder is that apparently a few days after his death, she was seen having a jolly time playing golf.
That's amazing that still now, if you want to slander someone in power... After any major incident where we feel like they should be in mourning or just burning the candle at both ends working, they've seen with a golf club in their hands. Uh-oh.
You think she delivers a speech indicating how she's completely innocent, she's really, really sad about the murder, and she's not guilty at all.
Now watch this drive.
And she, I say, she's a typical Stuart, so she loves dressing up.
Yeah, of course.
She and her 4 Marys, her women who are all called Mary and are... her maids of honour, as it were, sometimes would dress as men at a banquet. She goes around Stirling. Apparently they were begging to see how generous people would be.
Mm. And really? What? Yeah. I mean, did everyone go, give her a load of money, that's a queen. Yeah. And also, of course, dressing up as a washerwoman.
The English ambassador apparently had himself recalled when Mary decreed that everyone in a progress around Argyle should wear Highland dress for the trip.
Hang on, what... The ambassador was recalled because he didn't have some kilt on.
No, he had himself recalled because he didn't want to do it.
Because he didn't want to do it. I once left a job working in a bar because I didn't want to dress as a caveman. I'm not the most prized specimen of a man. And they were going to have me in like this leopard skin leotard. So forget it. I'm out of here.
Well, I wasn't expecting that. And John Knox, perhaps not very surprisingly, moaned that all men were bewitched by Mary, who kept herself very grave with her advisers, but when her French fillocks, fiddlers, and others of that band got the house alone, there might be seen skipping.
Oh, unbelievable!
Not very comely for honest women.
And I see how they're French fiddlers. Yeah. French fiddler definitely sounds like euphemism, doesn't it? Good
French
lord.
French fiddlers and fillocks.
Oh, hoo-hoo.
So it's quite a fun time at court, it seems.
Yeah, I was not expecting that.
Mm. And there's evidence that she was attempting to do some pretty good rule. In terms of finances, a big benefit of Mary as queen is that she is the Dowager Queen of France. Mm. And as such, she's given 30,000 Scottish pounds a year of income.
Wow.
By the French, which basically covers the cost of her royal household. So all of this party and literature and art and stuff, it's tapestries that she's got, it's all paid for by the French, basically. So she only raises one national taxation in her reign, and that's for James's baptism.
That must have been an awfully big party if you have to raise a tax for it.
Yeah, it was a good sort of £12,000 or something.
It's an awful lot of cucumber sandwiches, isn't it? And white wine after the bit of plonk after the do.
She had a very difficult scenario returning to Scotland, as we said before. She's a Catholic, the country's turned Protestant, it's all very, very difficult. But she does a pretty good job of trying to, say, find that middle way.
Mm.
She rejected an offer from Catholics of leading a campaign against the Protestants and basically starting civil war. She accepts the religious status quo, she had a balanced court, and indeed her half-brother, the Earl of Murray, who ultimately turns against her, initially he backs her against John Knox, who's complaining that she gets to practice mass in private. Murray saying, look, she's doing everything we want to do, everything's perfectly reasonable.
Just hold off being such a stick in the mud for 5 minutes, John.
1562, as we said, she put down that rebellion by the Catholic Earl of Huntly.
Yeah, yeah.
Showed that she was willing to stand up for law and order rather than just throwing her lot in with the Catholics. And at the Stirling baptism, which comes after the Chaseabout raid and after the murder of her musician David Rizzio, she really does try to set a new and better tone of reconciliation. She pardons Murray and Argyll, and they are brought back to the court. Tries to promote liberty of conscience in religion and have some more financial concessions to the Reformed Church. And she's going to try and position herself as the patron of both Catholic and Protestant churches.
She's doing all she can.
Hmm. And as she said, despite the civil, despite her abdication, there's still a lot of support for her. She's able to raise armies in 1565, 1568. Civil wars continued to 1573, even though she hadn't been in the country for 5 years.
Yeah, yeah. Very good so far. I've struggled to see how you're going to get any negatives here.
It's an incredibly chaotic rule, ultimately.
That is a good point.
Putting to one side that basically the first 10 years is kind of the rough wooing and being invaded by England, which obviously she doesn't have any control over, but it's,
she's queen.
It's not an awful lot of fun. She's in France from 1548 to sort of 1561, 62. So she's not actually there for quite a bit of the reign. And then she has a few good years, but 1565 to 67, it is just chaos. Marrying Darnley brought the Lennox faction back, disturbed the balance of power with the nobility, and then we have the Chaseabout raids.
Mm.
After this, it should have been the real high point for Mary, where she was able to really cement her position once she'd sent everybody off. But it all goes wrong in just over about a year. She starts encouraging some of her nobles to attend mass. She's seen as favouring her predominantly Catholic royal household for advice instead of the Privy Council. People like Rizzio. That's why they want to kill him.
Yeah, it's a bit extreme. Yeah, absolutely.
And it all falls apart quite quickly. The relationship with Darnley is a disaster. She promised in the crown matrimonial there were coins showing face with them facing each other in his name first. She realises her mistake, but as a result, Darnley gets fed up and starts plotting against her.
Yeah.
Whether or not she was guilty of murdering Darnley, her response to it is politically disastrous.
Mm.
As we said, you know, not observing mourning rituals, not even pretending to be glad of him, it makes her look guilty.
It makes her look very guilty, yeah.
And for someone who's really meant to be pretty gifted in symbolism and gesture politics, that's really a key part of being a Renaissance monarch, and particularly a queen, as we see with Elizabeth in England.
Yeah.
It's a pretty bad failing in how she conducts herself.
It's a really odd blip in her character, that marriage and how quickly it went bad and how badly she dealt with it going bad.
And then, as said, the marriage to Bothwell, hugely unpopular with the nobles, who widely suspect him of murdering Darnley. Mary viewed him as her only protector, so sort of acquiesces in this rigged trial and then marries him just a few months after Darnley's death. But, you know, this ultimately provokes a civil war.
Yeah, I feel like she, when things are going well, she does really well. And as soon as she starts tying herself in knots, tries to undo things, and it just rolls up.
And the civil war, really, which doesn't finish until about 1573, really pretty chaotic. A lot of the major leaders are assassinated. This creates a really chaotic world for her son, James VI, to grow up in.
Mm. Yeah, all right, I take it back.
There's some more.
Oh.
Marriage to the Dauphin, Mary signed secret documents in which she agreed that Scotland would be given to France if she died without an heir.
Oh.
In addition, Scotland would pay 1 million pieces of gold for the cost of defending Scotland and Mary's education. Secret marriage treaty, but one which is widely rumoured, and it helps fuel the sort of Protestant nationalist opposition. Yeah. To Mary of Guise at this point. In terms of religion, Jenny Wormald has said that actually Mary makes a big mistake in not taking the Catholic offer to just start straight away by raising an army and sweeping them away.
Really?
Because she says at this point, the Protestants are dominant in terms of the nobility, but the country is probably largely Catholic. She's got this opportunity to come in, sweep the Protestants away, and get the Catholic regime back in place. And that would have made her much more appealing as an ally to Spain and to France.
But then definitely cutting off any chances with England.
Maybe, but perhaps if her focus had been on ruling in Scotland rather than trying to become ruler of England, maybe she would have been a more successful Queen of Scots.
Yeah, and would have died with the head attached.
Hmm. She's also a bit, perhaps, ignorant of how things work in Scotland. As you said, she was only 6 days old when she became Queen, never trained in Scottish statecraft because she grows up in France and kind of takes on quite a French identity, really.
Mm.
She never understands the sort of factional, self-interested nature of Scotland. And she's a bit naive in many ways. You know, she goes along with that marriage agreement. Apparently, while her mother was regent, she once sent her 35 blank sheets with her signature at the bottom.
Oh, what?
Hmm.
That's crackers. Was that rumour or was that true?
No, she does that. She does that.
Wow, she's trusting.
She was caught out with the Babington plot when, having been completely isolated from all her previous contacts, she suddenly has a good fortune to be presented with a Catholic postman who's willing to send all her messages off in all these sorts of places. There's a sense that maybe she's not a great judge of character.
You've certainly given her a marriage record.
Mm.
But just what you said there, I've got a question written down here. If not Darnley, then who?
Well, you know, maybe... maybe he wasn't such a bad choice in terms of the reality of the situation that she wasn't going to marry Dudley, who's Elizabeth's choice. And the foreign matches weren't going to be popular with England either.
Should she have done an Elizabeth and not married at all?
Well, that was one option. I think she sort of made clear that that was never one that would work for her.
Because I just had a little theory, though.
Because she wanted an heir.
Yeah. And actually, the best thing she did was the fact that all her subsequent marriages... And the murder of Darnley meant that when Elizabeth did die, there was only this one guy who actually ended up joining the thrones.
Mm.
And although Mary never got to be queen, the situation was such that it actually ceased all this nonsense.
But if you make that contrast with Elizabeth comes close to marrying Dudley, but never actually does it.
Yeah.
Because ultimately she knows that it will be a disaster. She doesn't marry the Duke of Anjou, which she came close to doing when there's such opposition. Maybe Mary tends to throw her lot in with the moment. Like you said, she just gets in and does something.
I think that's the only difference between them, actually. That's really true, because also when they're in exactly the same boat and imprisoned and have plots presented to them, Elizabeth doesn't go to find that final centimetre and actually put her name to something. Just gives it a nod and a wink.
Yeah.
She's just got a little bit more about her, Elizabeth, perhaps.
There's an awful lot of chaos. And as you said, she does have to abdicate in 1567.
Mm.
So she's only really ruling Scotland in person for about 6 years.
I've actually forgotten the good bits now, beyond the dancing.
There was a lot of dancing. There was dressing up.
Love a bit of dressing up, Graham.
Glittering court. Bit of golf. And there were the early years of her personal rule where she was trying to steer that middle course between the Protestants and the Catholics, and doing a fairly decent job. And there's an awful lot of dramatic events, like the murder of Rizzio, the murder of Darnley, all the rebellions. There's lots of stuff that just happens and it gets out of control. It's not necessarily all her fault.
It's her marriages that are at fault. It is tumultuous, isn't it? It's too chaotic to... If you were, getting back to basics here, would you like to have been a citizen under the reign of Mary? Probably not.
It's only really got a few years of her touring around, playing golf and having a few parties, but that doesn't last an awfully long time.
And you're probably not getting a look in on those.
Four,
three. If she were to be given a different set of cards, I'd think that she could do really well. If she was Elizabeth, mind you, she wouldn't have survived the time of captivity. Well, there you go. Just not quite. I think...
You know, she's probably, in her defence, she's probably got one of, if not the hardest scenarios to take on.
Yeah, she's playing the level on godlike genius mode.
And, you know, it's not her fault, as I said, with the Catholic Church, for example, had been such a source of strength to all the previous Scottish monarchs, such a key bulwark against English attacks in boosting the monarchy's position. But by the time she becomes queen, it's been completely overturned and there's a Protestant regime which is against her. Every other monarch before her had the church as a huge support, and she has it as a crucial enemy.
Yeah. The hand of cards as well that she was given at the start was pretty good as well. That point where she's Queen of France. Yeah.
But, and again, you know, 1559, the King of France, Henri II, dies at the height of his powers. The next year, her mother and her husband, Francis II, the new King of France, die.
And with that, all support goes out the window. She's
the
left
Protestant with... Reformation happens in 1559-60 as well. It all happens in this year. You know, none of it in any way under her control.
And she's left in Scotland, foreign land, and all of the people around her have a finger in the pie. But I really like her, though.
It makes you sympathetic, but it doesn't make her reign any more successful.
No, but she does do everything she can.
Yeah. So, a score.
I can't remember what I said. Did I say three? But I think I'm feeling like a two.
Hmm.
That is because in the GCSE, she was studying so hard, star pupil for biology and sat a physics paper. And she got an incredibly low score, but she did everything she could. She applied the science that she knew, and it just wasn't appropriate. Yeah, two.
I'm going to be a bit more generous and give her a four, I think. Maybe similar to the scandal in a way, that I feel like a lot of the disasters aren't entirely her fault.
No.
She's a bit of a victim of events. And actually, she does some pretty good stuff. She's quite sympathetic. She tries.
She does try.
The best that she can.
Mm.
But you can't disguise the fact that it isn't a successful reign. So that is a 6 for subjectivity.
Longevity.
She is a queen from the 14th of December, 1542, to the 24th of July, 1567, which is when she abdicates. Not when she dies.
25 years.
24.58 years.
Oh.
Which gives her a score, and a not too bad score, of 13 out of 20.
Not too bad at all. Above average.
Indeed, but think if she hadn't abdicated and had managed to live at least to when she was executed.
Yeah.
Another 20 years.
Yeah.
Could have been very, very good.
Very, very good.
Dynasty, not the program.
She has one surviving child,
mm-hmm.
of course, which in Scotland means that's a score of 2.
Ah.
Out of 20.
Not good.
Not good, but ultimately the dynasty does continue.
Does it half?
Unlike with Elizabeth. So although it's only 2 points, it's actually quite a significant 2 points. So that gives her a total score of 33.5.
When we were adding those up just then, is she the highest scoring headless monarch?
Well, so in Scotland, 33.5 puts her... in 20th place.
Okay.
Out of, that'll be 41. So she's basically mid-table.
Mid-table, that's pretty good.
It's not too bad.
Especially for the level she was playing. And Charles the First?
28.02.
Way! So the highest scoring executed monarch. Brilliant. That is a claim to fame.
It's a claim to fame, but is it enough for her to find some glory right at the end? Does she have that certain something, that lasting legacy, that great achievement, that star quality that we call...
Rex Factor!
She's not got a particularly high score.
Mm.
In many ways, her reign is, apart from a little brief ray of sunshine, just one big cloud of disaster and failure.
Mm.
But she does have a certain something about
her. She does have a certain something, there's no denying that.
Mm. You've been sympathetic towards her, I think. You've been liking her.
I have been liking her, but I don't know whether that's enough.
Mm.
The fact that she was a woman in this time makes things so much more difficult for her.
I think, on the basic level of being a successful monarch...
Yes and no, yeah.
She is not a successful monarch, despite her best efforts.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that, you know, she's in many ways not always her fault,
she
isn't successful. The question is, can you get the Rex Factor without being a successful monarch? Are you able to have the star quality and that certain something and get the Rex Factor regardless of how well your reign actually went?
I feel that the answer to that question should definitely be yes. Is there a... an instance when we've done it in the past?
No, so we didn't. I don't think we've really had an unsuccessful Rex Factor winner. If she's a victim of events, can she get the Rex Factor when things are being kind of done to her?
And she's reacting as well as she can.
Mm.
So well, she tries to take the initiative, though, doesn't she? She does like launch, say, right, well, there's an issue. Let's go and chase them off around the houses.
Mm.
Yeah, and when she isn't in a sticky pickle, she's taking charge, and then it just events conspire. Maybe a Rex Factor winner wouldn't let those events conspire.
Mm. It's the question of whether you sort of look at kind of 1561 to 65 and think, wow, look at how good she could have been if they just let her alone, or do you look at 1566 to 68 and think, oof, that went south pretty sharply.
Didn't make any good decisions those couple of years.
Mm. Do you take into account, you know, the legacy aspect of history, the way that she has that moment when, you know, she is executed and she has her last star moment, the fact that her son does become the King of England and Scotland. The fact that it's Elizabeth II is a direct descendant of Mary, Queen of Scots. She's not a direct descendant of Elizabeth I.
Oh.
Because obviously Elizabeth doesn't have any children. So.
Yeah. I think I'm going to stick my neck out here, pardon the pun, and say that she does. Mm. And you know, your point about her on the scaffold tipped me over the edge there.
Mm.
I think that resilience and the level of the difficulty that she was playing the game, okay, was too much. Would have been too much for anyone. I can't even imagine even Edward I... having, you know, as much success as he did, given those odds. And she was herself to the end. She was an incredible woman.
Mm.
And, yeah, her bravery in death. Mm. I'll say yes. Ooh. That is star quality.
It is a tricky one. I've been, it was one from sort of early on, as soon as you said we're going to do this series, it's sort of one of the ones that people are saying, oh, will you give the Rex Factor to Mary, Queen of Scots? And I was thinking, well, I mean, she's not really a very successful queen.
She wouldn't, she would be standing on the mountain.
Hmm.
And she would be standing there with her, not her sword held aloft maybe, but she could hold her head. Oh, dear. Very high.
Far too high.
Literally. She could hold
it. Doesn't look right.
She's 6 foot tall, right? She could be holding that head 7 feet in the air. It's macabre, but that's the image.
I think the Rex Factor element with her, and like you said, the legacy, both in terms of the moment, the execution moment, the way that she plays that, and she's very much got... So go back to the biography episode, part two for that, the way that she projects herself as a Catholic martyr, the way that she's dressed so well, conducts herself so well, ensures that, a bit like with William Wallace being executed, that they get rid of her in the moment, but actually that ensures her place in history.
Yeah.
That, and of course James VI, which would not have happened had she not married Darnley.
Yeah.
And the style quality she does have in life, I think it can be possible to... have the Rex Factor without being a successful monarch. Mm. I think Mary does have the star quality. She's not a successful queen. Mm. I think that absolutely has to be acknowledged. And when we come to the Rex Factor playoffs, I feel that the not being a successful queen will count against her pretty strongly.
Mm.
But because of the legacy, because of the star quality, because of all of that, I am
going to let her join. We'll have annoyed hundreds, but pleased some more. So, you know, great. That's what we'll get the debate going.
It's also, I think, a setting of precedent for future series that there are different ways that you can get the Rex Factor.
Yeah, it felt like new ground, but now that the decision is made, I was agonising. We never discussed this beforehand, but now the decision is made, I'm comfortable with that. Mm. I think we need to open it up to those to that issue.
If you disagree with us... then do get in touch. We are at Rex Factor Pod on Twitter and Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
You can like us on Facebook.
Please do.
You can email rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com and you can go to our blog, rexfactor.wordpress.com, and complete a poll for all of the English and Scottish monarchs to say whether or not you think each of them deserve the Rex Factor.
They'll be running for eternity, so have a go.
If you want to support the podcast, you can spread the word by telling all of your friends and family.
That is our most effective form of marketing.
You could leave a review on iTunes and subscribe.
That is our most effective form of marketing.
If you would like to support us financially, you can make a one-off donation via PayPal.
That is nice.
Or if you'd like to do a monthly pledge to us, then you can join our Privy Council. Click on Be My Patron. Everybody who does that gets access to our special Privy Chamber bonus podcast that we record after each of our reviews. If you donate $5 a month or more, you get access to our special episodes, which usually cost $2 a time.
Yeah, they're fun.
And if you go right up to the top, $25 a month, you can commission a special episode on the subject of your choice.
Lovely. And T-shirt.
Yeah. Some new Privy Counters to welcome.
Oh, yes. Lovely.
Lauren Milkerek.
Hello, Lauren.
Evan Bernard.
Hello, Bernard.
Or Bernard.
Bernard.
Aaron Brooks.
Hello. I'm going to do this first. Can I just do hello at the end?
Yeah.
Okay.
Jen Matthews.
Hmm.
Chad Burns.
Chad! Hello.
And Emma Liza.
Hello, Privy Counselors one and all. Chad is like one of the originals.
Been there a long, long time.
Yeah.
Some messages.
Yep.
To finish us off. Ellie Simmons.
Let's have a look.
At the top.
Yeah, Simmons. Simmons say.
Ellie says. And she just finished listening to Robert II and was really pleased to hear us talking about the Battle of Otterburn in 1388 because she grew up 2 miles from the battlefield.
Oh.
And she has quite a personal memory about the battle.
How old is she?
Her mum was a teacher and once took the kids at Otterburn Primary School out onto the battlefield to recreate it. And she brought Ellie along when she was about 18 months old in a pram so she could teach and babysit at the same time. So Ellie says, I remember as distinctly as if it were a film that one of the kids mimed firing an arrow at her and she went to the ground clutching her chest in a spectacularly dramatic death. And there was me, a toddler, not really understanding what was going on, but apparently understanding enough to think my mum was really dead, and so I started crying.
Wow.
She quickly came back to life and herded the kids back into school. I can only apologise for ruining their fun, but I can also say that my very first somewhat traumatic memories are of the Battle of Otterburn.
Oh, wow.
P.S. I currently live 3 streets down from a Dunstan Road.
I mean, he is... Once you're looking for him, he is everywhere. Every single town has a Dunstan Road, Dunstan Street. It's unbearable.
Jennifer Bunkley is promoting a book that she has written.
Oh, yeah.
In a piece of brazen self-promotion, I wanted to alert you to Palgrave Macmillan's recent publication, My Book, Gender, Pregnancy and Power in 18th Century Literature, in the hope that some Rex fans might be interested. It covers the reigns of a few Georges and has a chapter featuring George I's royal anatomist, who was bizarrely involved with the case in which a woman claimed to have given birth to 27 rabbits.
I was not expecting that. Oh, dear. That's a book for me.
And there's a relevant story about James VI, because there's theories about the impact of events happening whilst a woman was pregnant on her child.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There was a popular belief that James had a horror of war and violence because Mary, Queen of Scots, witnessed Lord Darnley murder her friend David Riccio whilst pregnant with James.
And all kinds of other stuff. She was, yeah.
Finally, a few new Privy Councillors. Alan Cook says that he's looking forward to the specials, particularly William Marshall on Isambard Kingdom Brunel, which he'll listen to with his 6-year-old son Sam, who loves all things Brunel, especially his bridges and trains.
Oh, brilliant. Well, hello, Sam. I hope you enjoy Brunel. What a character. I mean, if you like bridges and trains, other than Fat Controller, he's your man.
Tracy Muir said, I listened to all of the English Kings recently, as in our episodes on them. I saw a photo of you both early on, but for some unknown reason, I swapped your identities.
That's come up a lot.
I just put the right voice to the right person a couple of weeks ago, and it's now very weird listening to the Scottish Kings.
I know exactly what you mean. I hate it when that happens.
So that is it for Mary, Queen of Scots, who joins her many of her illustrious predecessors.
Congratulations.
On the Rex Factor Mountain. We've only got one more to do, James VI, her son. Will he be the last Rex Factor winner for the Scots?
And I genuinely cannot remember if we gave it to him or not in the first time, and he's the only one we'll ever do twice.
That will be the last in the main part of the Scottish series, and after that, of course, we'll be moving on to the playoffs.
Just in time for Christmas.
Just in time for Christmas. But until then, it's goodbye from me.
Cheerio!